Welcome back to Tasteland. I am Francis Deer.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking with today?
We're talking with my friend Trey Taylor. He had a long career in media at places like The Face before pivoting to advertising, specifically targeting Gen Z consumers. And then he learned how to make perfume and he just launched his perfume brand, Serviette. The launch party was so cool, tasteful. I'm sure he'll tell you about this, but he played off the idea of a serviette as historically a face covering in addition to being a napkin, and had his perfumes set beautifully at place settings. And I am currently wearing one of his perfumes right now, so I'm excited to get into it with him.
I'm excited to hear all about it. One thing, while we wait for him, one thing I wanted to talk about that's been on my mind since we spoke to Kat D is how she said that the internet is oral history. Internet history is oral history. And then sometime in the last couple of weeks, I started thinking about how like AI writer panic and like, you know, is AI going to replace writing? I don't think it is. I think that's a whole nother conversation. But also like people reading less, and I like trying to take like an optimistic edge on it without getting into the doom and gloom.
Well, I wouldn't know people are reading less based on their response to Dirt launching our book's publication blank, because it has been wildly enthusiastic.
Well, okay, you know, you're serving a rarefied portion of the population here, to be sure. But okay, you can talk about that. You can talk about blank because we forgot to talk about that last week. But what I will say,
I didn't forget.
You did.
Okay, you had an agenda. It's okay.
I had an agenda. I was in a mood. But no, could there be like an exciting new oral culture? Like, is there a new way of like treating? I mean, for one, you are a serial voice note sender. That's oral culture. Podcasts, oral culture. I don't know.
Stop saying oral. I don't know. You invent some sort of new word.
Jesus.
Spoken word.
Spoken word. Okay. Spoken word culture. What is this? Slam poetry?
It might be.
No way. That sounds like the worst podcast concept of all time.
This is what I think though. I think if oral culture is not at some point converted into text, it's lost to history. Things can circulate orally, but the ones that are the most lasting, there's an oral tradition and there's a text tradition. And I think that that's like what we're seeing with the sort of like, not collapse of podcasting. Obviously, podcasting's still really strong.
Well, wait. Sorry to interrupt quickly. Maybe it's the better word audio culture rather than oral culture. Audio implying like audio files instead of oral.
I think audio and text have a symbiotic relationship. They need to work together. A lot of the podcasts that have been produced have been very relevant in their time, but audio culture really lives in like the present moment. It's really hard to archive. You can't archive it the same way that you can archive text. I think the most lasting things produced during this period and on the internet and by the internet will have to have some relationship to text in time in order to be historically relevant.
Obviously,
that's very self-serving to me, but that's just what I think.
To that point, our guest is here.
Let's
let Trey in. And listener, you will listen to this, but you can also read an excerpt of it in Dirt audio to text shortly after. Anyways,
we're making scent history.
We're making scent history.
Hey.
What's up?
Hi.
It's so good to have you. I was telling Francis in the intro, I'm wearing Serviette right now. I'm wearing Frisson d'hiver.
Okay. Frisson d'hiver. Love that.
Sorry, I botched the French. It's interesting. So the other thing I said is I got like really shy about taking samples. So I only took 2 out of 4, which was really dumb because that was the whole point of the event. But I was like, I shouldn't be greedy. So
you should have taken 6.
I should have taken 6. I also had my backpack, which when I saw a photo of how full the event got, I texted our mutual friend Colleen. I was like, it's really good I left when I did because A, I would have been extremely overstimulated. B, like the backpack was not going to fly.
Right.
And by backpack, I mean my like very slim laptop backpack.
Like but it would have been a gauche.
Yeah. Something about putting the samples into the backpack felt very illicit to me. And after like 2, I just got profoundly self-conscious. But I did think Sour Diesel was going to be my favorite, and I did love Sour Diesel, but this one is really growing on me.
Oh, okay. I think it's so interesting how people have, you know, in their mind, they're like, I love Sandalwood. And then they're like, wait, actually, I like this other scent that has no Sandalwood. And I'm like, you know, you think one thing and you smell another thing, and it just, it's different, you know?
So tell us more about the launch event and how it came together and how people have been sort of, what the feedback has been as people sort of get their hands on the scents.
I mean, what's interesting is I have never hosted an event in my life.
Oh, you're lucky you got away this long without doing it, because it's very stressful. I'm planning one right now.
Like, I'm not the person to, you know, have friends over even, because it like freaks me out. So the fact that I was sort of the center of everyone's roving gaze and like comments was kind of terrifying. And I think what's also interesting is like, I've spent 5 years now creating these fragrances in isolation, like the only person I've had to kind of give any sort of feedback is like my boyfriend, Daniel. And so when you suddenly have like nearly 100 people coming up to you being like, I love this one, this one's like, I mean, people are very effusive, and I'm sure it's all, you know, true, but they were like, oh, this, you know, this changed my life. Like, this one's my favorite, blah, blah, blah. I can't wait to wear this and show this person. And, you know, it's sort of like, I imagine what a wedding day would be like, where, you know, everyone's like, it must be the happiest day of your life. And if you say no, there would be like,
well, offended. I mean, like a wedding, this event isn't so much for you as it is for other people, right?
Right, right. Yeah. And I'm, you know, like a not like a wedding, you're kind of promoting something. So
which one were you wearing at the event of the four?
I wore Byronic Hero, which is this deep rosy oud, which has like this fir balsam note and like this cutting note of diesel exhaust. I really wanted all of my fragrances, there's four of them, to have a kind of like unexpected note that would maybe catch you off guard in a way, or even be like slightly off-putting, where you're kind of like, oh, on the face of it, this smells nice, but hold on a second, what is that? Like, did a car just drive by and like the carburetor, I don't know what those words are, but you know, did something like blow up in my face? But it's very, I don't know, it's very wearable. Like, nothing is here to freak you out. I'm not an experimental perfumer by any means. I want to go, you know, in with these sort of comfort rendering scents. Like, there has to be some kind of familiarity to it, because I don't think anyone, especially when it comes to fragrance, wants to be pushed too far outside of their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And if they do, there's shit for that. Like, there's a freak scent too that like, yeah, you can find scent somewhere. But for me, I think like we all have an immediate reaction to scent that we don't maybe have with other things.
This isn't like the Krishan Magnifique.
No, exactly. Right.
Well, so, is Byronic Hero the closest to what you gave me in like 2022?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I was an early tester. So I loved that thing. I rode that sample into the dirt. I was like, you know, last like sort of sprays, like, come on, come on. And it's one of the ones that I forgot to take, which is like figures. But
we'll get you one.
Thanks.
How do you, wait, so you started teaching yourself how to do this in 2020, which I don't know so much about perfume production, but it seems like a particularly hard thing to have to teach yourself. I understand that like ingredients are expensive, et cetera. How did you teach yourself how to do this?
Well, the startup costs are astronomical. I basically like, I don't know, in my mind was saving up for the eventual house purchase. And like was nowhere near a deposit, but all of that is completely gone and self-funded into this like perfume brand.
You know what? Who knows where we're going to be in 10 years?
Right.
Follow exactly. Your bliss.
Like, I could be house poor or fragrance rich, and I chose fragrance rich. So
that's beautiful. Thank you for that on the hat.
Right. So I, you know, bought all of these essential oils from Italy in the pandemic. I was like, oh, this looks like a reputable company. It was like recommended on some Reddit thread probably. And I bought like all of this wax. I was going to make candles. I was going to like create scents for the home, cozy up my atmosphere. And then making candles is really hard. Like, it's like making perfume plus the added step of like putting it into wax and making it somehow come through. Like, it's really difficult.
Is it easy to like?
I would never even attempt that.
Can you like kind of cook the scent out with the hot wax or something?
No, because certain aroma chemicals have like a certain amount of grow essentially in like candle terms. So that's kind of why any citrus candle you find smells like cleaner, you know, because there's no real natural citrus smells that like project that well.
Yeah.
The evaporation curve on a lot of citrus materials is like really, would it be high, low? I don't know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they evaporate quickly. So like, all to say, I was making candles. It was ridiculously difficult. They all smelled horrible. I had bought like a giant box of wax. I was like, why did I buy this? And a friend of mine, Maxwell of UFO Parfum, who's a friend of Dirt as well.
Big friend of Dirt.
Yeah. They were like, why don't you just skip the wax and add ethanol and like, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. You've got a perfume. And I was like, really? Is it that easy? I mean, in theory, yes. But like, yeah, it took me about a year to create something that wasn't complete garbage. And I don't know if
only a year.
Maybe that is a short amount of time, but I think like for anyone doing a hobby, like maybe in a week you figure out how to play like a good song on the guitar.
Well, I guess the question there, like besides it taking a year, is like how much, I don't know if you like have a dollar amount, but like how much of like, you know, these materials are you using to like get good? How many terrible vials have you made or whatever?
Ooh, oh, terrible, yeah. Vial is a great name for something.
Right. I have like a whole drawer full of sample, you know, formulations that are just probably never going to see the light of day.
You should sell dollar people amount, like a $10 mystery box of unwearables. Like, I feel like people would buy it.
They'd buy it, but they would be like, what?
It would dilute the brand.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. But in terms of dollar amount, I definitely spent like a couple thousand. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to get into perfume, but I think because the perfume industry is so arcane and like Byzantine, you kind of do have to trial and error your way into knowing what's going on. Like, the info is not readily available. You can't really go to the library and get like Perfume for Dummies. And mm-hmm. maybe that does exist, but the information that is available publicly and online, there's a wealth of it, but it's not all accurate. So like, you're kind of wading through this like minefield of information, which is how so many people end up like, well, either frustrated and broke, which is probably the most likely, or, you know, you're kind of creating in a way that's not good, I would say. You know what I mean?
I read last night when I was preparing for this, I read an article, I think, in High Snobiety about you and a few other like self-taught and independent perfumers that was talking about like how it what used to be so like basically impossible. You had to get like a chemistry degree, etc. But now you're kind of referring to some of the information that's out there on like Reddit and YouTube. Now it's much easier. And there was like, I mean, I didn't know of most of these people, but like, wow, there's so many. There's like, half a dozen people kind of semi-profiled in that article who are teaching themselves, and how it's like becoming easier. But then another thing was like, you have this mentor that was the mentor to another person, I think, mentioned in the article too. I guess what I'm asking is like, is it just that like now this information is out there, so it's like you can go look up the things and then you know, put in an order to Italy and you're basically good to go. And that just wasn't true as recently as like 10 years ago.
Yeah, basically all of the main fragrance and flavoring houses, which there are like, I think, 5 or 6 huge ones that make probably 99% of commercial fragrances and, you know, house cleaning and all the scented things you could ever come across, shampoos, conditioners, whatever, in your daily life, are kind of created by these same 5 conglomerates. Like, this is all like alleged or whatever, but I'm pretty sure they're kind of like cartel run situations. They have such a corner on the industry that all of the new scent molecules that are kind of invented or they come up with, they eventually just patent them so that nobody else can use them. Which is to say there's like a lot of smells essentially that exist that you or I cannot even work with because those materials are not available to us as like independent perfumers. So even to use a lot of these like molecules or materials, you have to work at one of these places, and getting a job there is like winning the lottery, essentially. Yeah.
This is like, Maine falls in this category, right? We've had guests before from Maine, and they do operate like across a lot of different chemical fields in this way.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's like part of the whole cartel situation, but yes, I do think like...
I mean, regardless where you, in any situation where you have a small amount, like publishing's the same way with the big 5, where you have a small amount of players in a market, there is always going to be some sort of de facto price setting, even if they're not directly collaborating. Mm-hmm.
Right, but imagine those publishers were creating books, but as a writer, even if you knew how to make a book, you couldn't purchase like the ink you needed.
Yeah, sorry, you can't use that word anymore.
Right, exactly. It's like, it's so tricky to kind of figure out. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people have illuminated the pathway, but for essentially centuries, it was like French people who were passing it down from father to son, and the still like the same dude works at Guerlain who's like grandfather founded it or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So like, and then of course places like Chanel, for example, they bought out the entire like south of France that has all of the roses that are used in like Chanel perfume. So if you wanted the rose centifolia or whatever that's grown in the south of France, you can't get it because Chanel owns them all. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's like, not only do they own the materials themselves because they're like patented and the molecules are only, you know, in their labs, but like some of the natural materials that you could only grow in this specific area are all bought out by these giant companies. So it's like, okay, you know, isn't that like crazy? Possible. I don't know. I find it crazy.
It is crazy. And I mean, one thing that I think this has come up on this podcast before, but the whole world of Fragrantica, I went to Fragrantica to see, you know, that people were sort of chatting about Serviette, which made me happy because I do feel like there's a little bit, you're sort of like anointed, right?
Once you're listed as a nose now.
Exactly. Right. Once your perfume's on there.
It's legitimized.
Like your book is on Goodreads. And then I went over, I tabbed over to check on our friend at UFO Perfumes to see if anyone had added the Dirt collaboration, and they had, but there's no scent profile and there's no reviews. And the reason why there's no scent profile is because Maxwell will not reveal even to me what's in it, other than to say it's a lot of different musks, which means it smells different to everyone because our bodies have evolved to respond differently to different musks. But every once in a while, I'll be walking through New York City and I'll smell it. And I know that it's not Knopp because there's so few bottles of it. And for a while I was like, oh, it must be because I have the empty sample is in my wallet. So maybe it's when I'm pulling stuff out of my wallet, it's just sort of like that's flickering nice up. But it's happened enough times where I'm like, did Maxwell trick me? And is this actually a repackaging of something quite common? Or is there something in here like totally unexpected, like, I don't know, like deer pee or something? And I love that I will never know and I will never ask them because I respect them too much to ruin the mystery. But I don't know. You just reminded me of it when you were speaking, like, about sort of like forbidden chemicals or patent chemicals. That there's other ways, I guess, that independent perfumers can respond with their own secrecy. Mm-hmm. And that actually makes me excited. Because like Maxwell literally could have put like an Ariana Grande elixir in there, cloud perfume elixir, and I would genuinely never know. But I smell it sometimes in the wild and I'm like, that can't be this perfume. So what is it?
Right. And so I think, especially if you are like, Maxwell's a brilliant at sourcing very rare materials from like places that you wouldn't have never heard of. But for me, for example, so I create all the formulas myself. All the materials that I purchase come from a bunch of different places. However, the actual formula gets compounded in a lab in California, and they only have access to the materials that they sell themselves. So anything that I have used to create like something unique, not using their stuff, I have to send them. So like the barrier to entry is just so high. I could be compounding everything here myself in my studio, but that's just not realistic at like the amounts and volume I have to do. So for example, say I'm creating like 500 bottles of one fragrance, but say there's like 0.003 grams of, you know, this one pyrazine material. Mm-hmm. So to purchase like the lowest amount of that material in a commercial sense would cost so much money that I would have so much of this material that it's just not cost effective to do. So I have to essentially outsource the compounding, which I think is good anyway, because it's like a real, you know, lab and it's everything safe and above board and whatever. Yeah, but sure. Like, you
and
know.
You're not giving you and Daniel brain damage.
And yeah, exactly.
Do you guys, like, isn't there like a culture of bartering and trading? I knew you told me at one point when you were learning that you were in like a Slack or a Discord with a lot of independent perfumers, like trading tips, evaluating some of this, like, info like on Reddit and online. Yeah. So do you do trades with other perfumers for some of these more rare chemicals?
I don't trade materials. It's just like a hassle. I don't want to like decant things. But what I will trade, and what is, I think, like kind of an open secret, especially with dupe culture being what it is, you can take any perfume. It is not a copywritten trade. You cannot copyright a scent. So I own nothing that I create.
Wait. You can't copyright a scent, but you're saying you can patent like the molecules. So you can't copyright the mixture, but you can copyright ingredients.
Correct. Okay. Yes. Mm-hmm. So like any formula anywhere, you can pay for what's called a GCMS, which is like essentially a chemistry printout of all the materials that are detected by the gas chromatography machine. That will give you a readout of what the formula is.
This is like getting a DNA test for your dog.
It's exactly like that. Yes. So just as Barbara Streisand cloned all of her five dogs or whatever, mm-hmm. you too can clone like the Tom Ford ombre leather, whatever. So like all of these formulas, if they have enough interest in like there being a clone of it, you can purchase the GCMS formulas of these to basically study, which I think has been very instrumental in learning, mm-hmm. you know, studying formulas of popular fragrances. But you have to pay for them all because it's just like independent labs that run these, you know, GCMS tests or whatever. Yeah. So I will trade those. Like if somebody else is like, hey, I've got, you know, Prada Luna Rosa, do you want to trade for like Versace Eros or whatever? Both fragrances I don't really care about, but do you know what I mean? It's like, oh yeah, I want to know how that is formulated. Trade like recipes. How did Jazz Club get that like boozy cigarette note? Or like mm-hmm. And then you can look through these, and oftentimes what is revealed is that like the thing that everyone talks about in that certain fragrance is actually not there at all. Like, everyone's like, oh, I love the, you know, the smoky note in this thing, or like the saffron is coming through so clearly. It's like, there's not a single note of saffron in here. You know, there's not a natural material within 100 yards of this fragrance. Mm-hmm. So like, that's been,
well, it's like a painter who's like known for their purple, but only ever used red and blue, right? And never like purple paint, or, you know, using two colors next to each other that produce the effect of a third color.
Yeah. And that's even kind of more interesting. It's like, I don't personally care that there's no, you know, natural saffron material, but how they figured out how to get that to come through using anything else is like, what? That's magic.
Wait, okay. Speaking of color, tell us about the choice of Kelly Green as the brand color for Serviette.
So essentially, I was very interested in class dynamics and power and the very like upstairs, downstairs thing of it all. So like, I am a sucker for Bride's Head Revisited, that whole like Downton Abbey-esque world. And baize, which is this like woven fabric that was used on pool tables. Now it's mostly felt, but it was also used on like the doors of these kind of grand country mansions, especially in England. It was a fabric that was like soundproof, essentially. So it would soundproof your living quarters from like the servants' quarters, for example. So the doors would have green baize on the one side, to kind of like muffle your, you know, rich whispers from the servants below. And so I kind of was inspired by that and chose it as a color for my brand.
A quick aside. Did either of you see The Brutalist?
Sure, yes. Did.
So I saw it 2 weeks ago, and at intermission, there was this older couple sat next to us, and she turns to us, the woman and the couple, and is like, don't you think like the landscapes are just like the Kelly Green? It's like, it's not realistic. It's insisting on itself. It's so like me, pick me. Which I thought was so funny, because I thought the landscapes were beautiful. And I thought I was like in awe the whole time. I loved it. But I was thinking of that when I was like, you know, preparing for this last night, and just that was the last time and first time in a long time I had thought of Kelly Green. But in that context, like, I'd been thinking of it as this thing that is so like rich and luxurious and dreamy in a way that does make sense for a scent brand, which is like about romance and like the storytelling of it all. Go ahead.
I just wonder if the absence of the green in certain scenes makes it look more stark. Because I've been thinking about this with Severance. Severance is all
I'm subdued. So tired of Severance, by the way.
Okay, we can do a separate episode about that. People are also tired of White Lotus.
I'm like, okay, well, White Lotus is
the prestige
good,
but... TV backlash.
and we're talking about The Brutalist, and we're also
Severance
actually not
is by design all green and blue. So when there is a red object or red lighting, it kind of comes in so heavy-handed. But is it heavy-handed, or is it just the contrast between the other things that you've seen up until that point? I guess there's probably a scent equivalent for this effect too.
Well, also, isn't that the point of Brutalist architecture generally? Like, it's so bleak and stark that like every other building is like, oh dang.
Well, yeah. and it's all those photos of like the Barbican in London, which is so beautiful because there's all this greenery and gardens around it, and like they pair so well, which is the point I made to this woman too. I was like, I brought up the Barbican. I was like, no, I mean, the point is the Kelly Green and the concrete like look so wonderful together and like serve each other so well.
And concrete absorbs light basically instead of reflecting it. So it's always going to offset the other objects around it differently.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is, you know, funny that you had such a like illuminating conversation about this with your fellow cinema patron, but I was seeing it and people next to me were Googling what is brutalism. So
that was like happening behind me. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
It takes all types. Well, right. I mean, I don't want to, make this like a family affair, but Trey's partner, Daniel, works at MUBI, and Daniel and Dirt have worked together in that regard. So, you know, wherever you're going, you're often with a cinephile as well. So I'm sure that also impacts your experience.
I often see films that are not often viewed. I'm in rooms with a lot of rare types, I would say.
I went to a good, I went to Anthology Film Center for the first time.
Ago.
It was the Volker Sprenger, I forget, retrospective. Mm-hmm. This actor who worked with Rainer Werner Fassbinder a lot. I watched this movie, Satan's Brew, which is like, it was really good. Definitely a sparse crowd and a bunch of weirdos, but it was kind of like, it was quite funny. I think it was like from 1973 or so, but it's basically about this character who is this writer. And it starts with him at his publisher's office, like pounding on the door, like, where's my advance? Give me more money. Like, it's not been enough. I'm out of money. And then the movie is like him on this rampage of, you know, artistic debauchery or whatever, and people worshiping him. And crucially, him not actually doing the work and writing the book that he's been given the advance for already. I guess I'm going to spoil it here. It kind of wraps up where like he finally is out of money. There's nobody left to scam. He's scammed his parents, who he hasn't seen in years and who are like scared of. He's scammed everybody. And finally, there's nowhere left to turn. So he writes the book so he can actually get the rest of his advance. But I recommend
sometimes
the movie.
Sometimes you just have to do what you say you're going to do.
You have to
stay. Right.
Well, I was going to ask about Serviette's Instagram. It's a lot of like, I feel like when you market perfume, you sort of market everything but perfume, because what you're really marketing is an aspiration and a lifestyle. You can't really show it to people because there's no way to convey that. And I thought about the same thing when I was like applying for my job at Hodinkee, which is like a watch magazine and retailer. I didn't know a lot about watches, but I think in the interview, I went on this like long monologue, like trying to convey like why I understood watch culture, because although you can show the watch, you can't really market the watch as essential because it's a completely inessential object. So there is a marketing problem with watches, just as there is with like perfume, of like, how do you make the case? And in order to make the case, you sort of do fall back on this like showing everything but the watch thing, where you're really selling a lifestyle. So I went on this like monologue about like the man at the bar, and everyone wants to be the man at the bar. Like, you see this guy, he's alone on a business trip. He's totally at ease by himself, like blazer on the back of the chair, you know, perfectly selected whiskey. And everyone looks at him and they want to be him. And like, that's the man at the bar. And when you're selling someone a watch, you don't say like, buy this Rolex. You say like, if you buy this Rolex, you will be the man at the bar. And so I feel like you've taken a similar approach with curated visuals on Serviette's Instagram. But despite that,
well, and your own Instagram, which is this side, there's just like this deep archive from
Trey never posts photos of himself.
Yes. I scrolled the entire Instagram trying to see if you'd ever. I went all the way back to 2017, not a single shred of you.
We do appreciate your due diligence, though. That's, but he is in it because he curated that.
Yeah, that's the point.
It's all him.
The red thread.
I mean, but despite this, there is this culture of blind buys. I guess I'm asking two questions. Like, part of it is like selling a lifestyle and an aspiration because you can't just reach through the screen and hand somebody a sample. And also, like, despite that, there is this a little bit of like a pride in the hubris of making like an audacious blind buy, because people are going to buy things they haven't had a chance to smell. And I'm sure that creates a whole other set of issues for like consumer brands that are constantly dealing with returns. But I don't know, there's something a little bit magical about that in 2025, where everyone's trying to have experiences that
you can't
be like
a perfume.
You know exactly what you're getting. Like, I'm going to go to Via Carota and I'm going to order the exact thing that I saw recommended on TikTok, and like, I know exactly how it's going to be.
Well, yeah, I think this is obviously a subject that you have spoken a lot about, you know, through the newsletter and personally for quite a few years now, which I have.
Are you sick of me yet?
No. But I think that we are in such an extreme version of capitalist culture right now where, and I don't blame anyone, but like every influencer is only trying to sell you something to continue to do whatever their passion is. So even if you follow somebody because of their taste or their looks or what they are purchasing, the signals they're showing you, it's all kind of this like weird, false, you know, sensibility in a sense. Like, I think that we've kind of become immune to people recommending things. And I don't, what I was trying to do or what I am trying to do through my brand is kind of like reintroduce the idea of having good taste by being more curious about things. Mm-hmm. I think that like there's been, and I said this at my event, like this kind of mass extinction level event of like the death of good taste, essentially, where, you know, everyone's resorting to these micro trends online. We are all like signaling the purchases we make. And I think especially in the past like 2 years or so, nobody shares anything anymore. And by that, I mean, like, even 5 years ago, if I went to Via Carota and I had a good pasta dish, hard grid post, you know, if I was reading like a really amazing book, like that's 5 Instagram stories. Nowadays, like you only share your own content. You're the only person that's excited about your own stuff going on. Mm-hmm. And nobody's like here to kind of celebrate you. So who is that person you're kind of showing to the world is like my question. And so I don't know, there's all this like buzzy world building, brands need to be worlds now. Like we all have to create members clubs and we all have to, you know, subscribe to like the world. The Real Real has the Real Girl Substack now that you have to subscribe to and read her musings. Like what? You know, I think we're just in this weird zone where I'm trying to, like, again, through the power of brand, the brand as storyteller, tell you that we need to get back to like finding your own personality without watching TikToks about how to find your own personality.
Well, okay.
No, that's so true.
You had a number of great lines on taste kind of on the website, in the logo, etc. I wrote them down, but there's one I wanted to read. You say, "We believe taste is about perception, not possession," which I thought was really interesting. You're kind of touching on it there. Say more about the relationship between perception and possession.
So I lightly got into, because I am taking my own advice as well here, but I lightly got into Pierre Bourdieu's theory of cultural capital. And he is this French sociologist who talks a lot about like, you can use your cultural knowledge and what you know to move through the world and into spaces that maybe you don't belong. So versus signaling that I deserve to be here, or I have value because I like have financial wealth or I know the right people, is superseded by the cultural knowledge that you have. So like by you going to the Anthology Film Archives, I can be like, oh, that's sick. I interviewed Jonas Mikus once, who was like one of the founding members of it. And he, you know, is like the godfather of like independence. Like, you know, these are the things that I think make us interesting. I actually did interview Whit Stillman, who is the director of Metropolitan, among other amazing films, Barcelona. And he said to me something that like, I maybe even misinterpreted, but sticks with me. You know, when someone like says something and you're like, wow, that's so profound. And they were like, oh, it was an offhand comment. Mm-hmm. But he said something about like, all we are is like what we consume, essentially. Like you are just a facsimile. You are like the amalgamation of everything that you consume. So essentially you are your taste. Right. You are your own taste, essentially. So like, to me, it's like, who are you? You are the things that you are passionate about. You are the things that you are curious to learn about. And I want that to sort of come through in what I'm presenting.
The Real Real Substack thing kind of reminds me of like when Urban Outfitters and Anthropologie had their like 4 consumer proxies. There was like 4 women and they were using like real women's names and they were supposed to represent the consumer proxy for a certain type of woman. So they had their hippie woman, they had their preppy woman. Could not tell you the names of these women, yet I could still quote pretty much bar for bar the Julian Casablancas tweet about liking everything in Urban Outfitters. And I think that just like goes to show like you can fabricate a relationship with your consumer, but ultimately, like, it's the relationship between me and Julian Casablancas that will be my lasting image of, like, what Urban Outfitters meant in, like, 2016. And furthermore, like, I do want to say, like, millennials were shit on for a long time. You do a lot of Gen Z marketing. Gen Z kind of gets shit on, and now Gen Alpha. I think Gen Z and Gen Alpha realize that taste is important, but they're trying to, like, reinvent it from first principles. So I saw this, like, excerpt today on Twitter that was like Gen Z just like reinvented bars, and it was like them being like, I just wish there's somewhere I could like go with my friends to have a drink, and it's like there is, and right. So they're trying to speed run taste, but what taste is, it's spending a year to make perfume, which probably felt like a long time to you or to learn how to make it, but like in the grand scheme of things, if you're going to make perfume for the rest of your life, taking a year to develop your skill and taste is actually quite a short time. And they think that they can do it by like subscribing to a Substack that's going to send them links. And it's like, that's part of it. But like, you've just created another algorithm for yourself.
This thing was actually so shallow too. She was writing about how like, oh, we should have a bar where you can just have, or not a bar, a third place where you can have a glass of wine and ice cream.
A third place.
And she was referencing a place in London that then I read the comments and she'd actually never been there. And it's apparently just another TikTok trap place with a long ass line. So she's inventing it, but she's never even experienced it.
Oh, like the potato place.
It's all abstracted.
They have a place that just gives out baked potatoes. Oh, yeah. This came up on our most recent episode.
Have you heard of the Laundrette?
That sounds familiar, but...
So... This is like my
I'm probably obsession. Thinking of French Laundry, actually.
No. So this like TikTok couple in Brooklyn, I think, started a laundromat. They started a laundromat, but it's like chic and they put couches in it and they serve like, I think, coffee or whatever. And all these, you know, Instagram reels and TikToks are like, the laundrette is disrupting laundry service. You know, it's creating a place that you can go and hang out with your friends while doing your laundry with organic like detergents. And it's like this girl, and you know, God bless her. I want to visit, to be honest. I want to have a party there. But like she's put
Serve a laundromat together. That would make a lot of sense for you. Yeah.
Right. Like Gen Z, you know, creating things from first principles, like very much like I'm starting a business that is the oldest thing in the world, but I'm going to disrupt everything by doing it. Because like there's a couch in there.
Yeah. Look, I mean, if I was 22 and living in Williamsburg, I would absolutely go there, but I would like hate myself for it. And also the first time they get bugs, it's all going to be over. Like the illusion is going to be shattered because people's dirty clothes are fucking disgusting and you can't sanitize that. And you cannot completely sanitize the experience. So you might as well do wash and fold with the rest of the real New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The fact that like the laundrette is probably killing the, you know, Chinatown laundry business is just another, you know.
I don't think that they can. Like, because the other thing about convenience is, like, for a neighborhood, sure, that's an amenity. But how far would you travel to do your laundry there?
Right. I don't travel. Like, I think there's 3 laundromats within a block and a half of me, at least. Like, why would I skip all 3 of those to go even 1 block further, right? Mm-hmm. Like, why would I have the humiliation of, like, carrying my laundry?
Right, far? Like, you're going to take a lift with your laundry bag to lunch to do your laundry.
Someone has. Someone's doing that right now.
Yeah, and, like, they're going to crash out and have to move back to Durham in, like, 12 months. Mm-hmm. It's like, life in New York is a marathon, not a sprint.
Are you like a wine person? I was wondering this because of the nose of it all.
Oh,
like
the terroir.
I did watch that incredible Apple TV show about wine. What's it called?
I don't know, but I did watch Sideways for the first time this week.
Drops of God. So it was like based on this anime and it's like a live action thing. And it's about this like, what do they call this? Like not a sommelier, but what are they called?
The people who... You know,
the people who like...
Vinter?
A Vinter, yeah.
Maybe, yeah. incredible show. But yeah,
apologies to the Vinters listening to this.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm a wine person. I like wine. Mm-hmm. I just, it doesn't do what you might think it does.
Yeah.
Well, I'm like manifesting a cool wine collaboration for you. Some nice pairings between your perfumes and wines. I would definitely pay for that experience.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is like, obviously serviette means napkin in mm-hmm. French. So
obviously,
just the obviously, I mean, obviously I'm
Canadian, we went over that so, in the intro, don't worry.
Yeah, I you know, grew up saying like serviette, or I don't know, my grandparents said like Chesterfield, meaning couch.
Mm-hmm. What? That's a
are you Canadian?
Yeah.
Maybe that's a Canadian thing.
I think it's a Canadian thing. But either way, I think that the brand is rife for like extension mm-hmm. into dinner service, into like, I don't know.
Just we're going to extend all, it into like, the dirty verse. We just haven't nailed that exactly.
Right. Yet. Exactly. There's like a lot of legs. Mm-hmm. Mm.
I'm still a little bit thinking about the online shopping aspect of mm-hmm, it all mm-hmm. because I have not sampled any of your four perfumes. And last night, as I was like looking at the Instagram and looking at the Fragrantica, and like trying to, you know, imagine the smells, and I'm not a sophisticated nose, you know, so I don't necessarily know how to compose all those notes, in my mind. But I am addicted to online shopping, and I was thinking I've never bought a perfume without smelling it in person. Like, to me, that's something that is so in person. And I've been trying to shop for clothes in person more too. And I think for so long, like when I was in college and I was living in Portland, Oregon, and there's like one shop there that I liked, but I was also broke. So I would have to buy everything like on sale or on eBay online. And now I can like afford to buy a piece of clothing in person. So I go do that. But rambling a little bit here, I think like going back to the experience of like shopping for perfume online and like building up this fantasy and like looking at the Kelly Green and looking at the you know, the font and like the videos. And
the very beautiful bottle with the asymmetrical cap.
And like convincing myself I can smell it. And then, you know, maybe I'll click buy, but really I live in New York, so I'll go to the places that stock it. I don't know. I was wondering if you have bought many perfumes sight unseen, either of you, on the internet.
I don't recommend it. I think like I used to live across the street from Bloomingdale's kind of as I was developing this brand. So I would go there like almost every day and just smell my way around the perfume counters. Mm. Seeing the fragrances that like I liked that were selling well, whatever. It was very much this like kind of cheesy market research phase that, you know, I could like make into some fabulous story, but it was truly just me shopping. But online, I just purchase a lot of samples. I have like hundreds of perfume samples. And mm-hmm. I think like if you get to the bottom of your sample, it's worth a buy. There's mm-hmm. lots that just like spray it twice and you're like, that is mm-hmm. not for me. And very much, I think like in trying to create a brand that does have this kind of universe around it in some sense, it is really hard to communicate that digitally only. Mm-hmm. Like perfume is kind of one of the last bastions of things you can like experience only in real life in that very moment. It's not something, as much as I can describe it to you, that, you know, I can send through the screen or whatever. So as much as I kind of hate this phenomenon of people describing scents in this like literary poetic Fragrantica coded detail, it really does work. Like people respond to the light kiss of like a airy breeze of the raspberry as it floats on the basket of bubble. Like mm-hmm. to me, that's just so, you know, cringe. But mm-hmm. I was going back and forth over how I wanted to write about my scents, like the copy itself. And I was like, I'm just going to list 10 things that each of these fragrances is inspired by. So like the Martin Margiela SS90 show, like Fourierists, like, you know, all of these kind of random things. And it was just not hitting. I was like, I'm laying bare kind of the references behind these to maybe have people like resonate with them. But at the end of the day, you're like, okay, what does that smell like? You know, mm-hmm. it smells like an airy breeze with a light raspberry note that dries down into, you know? So like, I think that's sort of the only kind of weapon we have, but I'm sure this has been discussed too at some point. Like, there aren't really very many words in the English language that are genuinely about smell and describing smell.
Yeah, I was going to ask like how your background in editorial helps with that, because you are working within a limited like group of phrases, but in a way that you're very advantaged because you spent so long working in magazines where like selling aspiration is the core mission.
Right. And getting it across in like 15 words or fewer. Mm-hmm. But my hot take is like, you think you know what sandalwood smells like. You're a huge sandalwood fan. You have no idea what sandalwood smells like. There's mm-hmm. like five different, you know, aroma chemicals that are, you know, sandalwood or sandalwood adjacent. And so I just think it's funny because like when I say, oh, this is like, you know, Egyptian geranium, that's like, that might mean something to you if you're maybe from Egypt or like grow geranium. But otherwise, like, you know, there's geranium from other countries as well that has like different nuances to it. And even if you smell geranium, it's like, would you be able to pick that out of something? I'm not sure. I took, I spent over a year learning how just like my materials. I did these blind smell tests and kind of figured out like how these things go together. You know, a rose has like 100 different components of different materials that you can like pick apart essentially. So there's like the clove spicy aspect part of it. There's like the deep jammy part of it. There's like the bright floral part of it. That's like linalool and like geraniol and all these other kind of chemicals. So I think that like, it's funny to me when people are like, oh my God, I love orange blossom.
Like, well, this to me is like, I don't know, like I think of being a kid and reading a book and discovering like so many new words that I didn't know the meaning of, but I, you know, you kind of intuit the meaning based on the context clues and et cetera. And I think like when you said Egyptian geranium, I smelled something, you know, I don't know if it was the same thing you would have smelled, but it's like, you know, you fill in the gaps, right? It's like when you have a blind spot in your eye and like you kind of fill in the gaps. I don't know.
Right. And so I think my point is like, especially when you're online shopping, that copy is meant to be evocative, mm-hmm. but I'm selling you essentially a fantasy. Like, there is a 2% population that like actually knows what exactly I'm describing. And even so, like people have described Frisson du Vert, which to me is like a very solar floral, kind of like, you know, a lily of the valley kind of popping out of the snow. People on Fragrantica are like, oh, this is a great sunscreen scent. And I'm like, okay, not mean for sunscreen, but there's no wrong answers. So you have to smell this in person and like try it on your skin and wear it out and see what your own interpretations are. Because like the one thing I've learned in doing this is the thing that I tell you you're smelling is what you're smelling. Like, I'll ask my boyfriend like, oh, what do you smell? And he's like, oh, it's spicy. It's this, it's that. And I'm like, is it Lily of the Valley? And he's like, yes, I smell that. And I'm like, it's a psychological thing.
Is like me when I'm at dinner with my friend who's a sommelier. Like, and I am like, this does taste like I'm laying on a hot stone with peach in my mouth. It tastes exactly like that.
Right.
I mean, I get vanilla powder and something green.
Yeah, because, you know, I think to whatever degree you've trained your nose or worn enough perfume in your life to like recognize certain things, I do believe people who love sandalwood actually do love sandalwood and know, you know, to some extent what it smells like. But the majority of people, you know, they might smell a fruity note, but they wouldn't know it's like raspberry, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It could be a strawberry. It could be like a blueberry.
I was going to say, like, what we talked about buying in person, like tell us or tell the audience where they can sample your perfumes in person right now.
So they are exclusively stocked at Stell, which is in both Nolita and Williamsburg in Manhattan. I will be hopefully expanding to other retailers soon. So stay tuned for that. But
I heard overall, you sold out and they had to refresh their stock.
Yeah, they sold out of Discovery sets. So we did a restock, which is really exciting. I'm just like kind of shocked at the reactions so far, I guess. I had no idea what to expect. Like, mm-hmm.
Do you think you had a lot of these kind of smell on smell, as it were, online sales too? Like on the strength of the brand and the fantasy?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I mean,
anyone who bought a bottle that doesn't live in New York, that has to be a blind buy. It's actually really easy for you to quantify right now, right?
Right, it is. And it's like crazy because I have people buying from like New Hampshire and like Utah and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how did you hear of this? You know,
what does it smell like in Utah?
Right. Yeah. So that is wild to me. Like, I haven't gotten past that. It's very exciting. That whether or not they continue to be like a fan of the brand, there is some piece of serviette in the world that like somebody was interested in.
So, yeah, I've heard people express this sentiment before. Like, when you have a creative project, it's so hard to step outside of it and see like really what you've accomplished. Like, I would love Dirt's audience to like grow and grow, but you could already fill a stadium with the number of people that subscribe to Dirt. And it's like, you know, you've created something that people find worth paying for, engaging with, thinking about, like, no matter what scale that's at. Like, as soon as you're beyond like 100 people, and I would say even 100 people is impressive depending on what you're making, like, that's incredible. Like, and it's also, it's never your friends and family. Everyone says that too. Like, it's not, you expect it to be your friends and family. They don't necessarily know how to value it. So these are strangers. These are people you've never met before in your life. And they are bringing into their home and putting on their body something that you formulated like in your house. Like, wow. Like, that's why I think more people who start their own thing need to give themselves a pat on the back. And I'm not talking about drop shipping. I mean, like, really creating something that reflects your taste. It's an amazing accomplishment.
The thing that I have talked to a couple people about is like my previous career in journalism, where the entire goal essentially was to write things that would connect with readers, you know, hopefully influence their taste or whatever cultural decisions that way. And in my, you know, mind's eye as like a burgeoning writer, I was like, I'm going to get showered with praise. I'm going to get emails from people who are like, I read your article. I ran to the cinema or whatever. Absolutely never happened. And so now that I have like a physical product that I'm sending out to people, the response is like night and day, where people are like in my DMs. Like, somebody messaged me this morning who's from like Trinidad or something. And he was like, even though I can't smell it, I like yours. Brand is so cool to me, blah, blah, blah. And that, I was like, this is what it might, because I used to interview actors all the time. And I'd be like, your movie's out. That must feel so amazing, you know? And they'd be like, yeah, it's pretty cool. And I was like, what is it about? Like, what is it that I'm missing here? And I think I finally kind of understand now that, like, when you have all of these people telling you how good something is, like, it's such a different feeling versus just doing it and kind of hoping that it's connecting with someone. So yeah, I don't know. It's in that sense, I'm just like very proud of myself that people are responding at all.
I think that's a perfect place to end it. We're proud of you too.
Thank you.
I'm very proud of you, and I will be representing Serviette proudly.
Amazing.
Thank you for coming on. See you all next week.